Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books in Medieval History, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and we're here today with Megan Moore, Associate Professor of French at the University of Missouri, to talk about her new monograph, The Erotics of Grief, Emotions and the Construction of Privilege in the Medieval Mediterranean, just out fall 2021 with Cornell University Press. Hello, Megan. How are you today?
Hi, I'm doing really well. Thank you so much, Yana, for welcoming me.
Oh, this is wonderful. I'm really excited to talk to you. We've been working on it for a while, so it's good that this is finally coming to fruition.
Yeah, I'm super stoked to be here and excited to be participating in your podcast.
All right. So our first job here is to try to place this particular book in your intellectual trajectory. So I'm looking at your past research, and I see your first book, Exchanges in Exoticism, Cross-Cultural Marriage and the Making of the Mediterranean, in Old French Romance, and I see a lot of work on emotions, and you continue your work here on Old French Romance, but you move out as a bit as well, all right? So let's talk about your source material before we get into anything else. This seems to be a pretty broad source base. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I'd love to. This book is sort of an expansion of some previous work on the Mediterranean, and I didn't even expect it to be about the Mediterranean, but I couldn't help myself. All my sources kept coming back to the Mediterranean. So I wanted to look a little bit more broadly beyond romance and look at other sorts of genres. So in the book, the first chapter focuses on fable, the second chapter is on romance, the third chapter is on epic, and the fourth chapter is on travel narratives. And I wanted to think more broadly about what it would mean for the Mediterranean to inflect all sorts of sources. And, you know, and I guess I was sort of not writing a book about the Mediterranean, and then suddenly I was. The book actually starts from a scene that I noticed in grad school, and sort of was the other way I could have gone with my whole dissertation project, because it's been near and dear to me for a long time. And that is when I saw this scene where I read in Eric and Aeneid, there's a scene where the female protagonist Aeneid is screaming over and crying and pulling out her hair over the dead body of her lover Eric in the forest, and this knight rides up and says, "You're so hot, you're so beautiful. I just cannot stay away. I've never seen a woman more beautiful." And I don't know about you, but when I'm crying, it's not a beautiful sight. It's like, there's like the ugly cry when you're, and especially in a moment of grief, I mean, people let everything go. And so why would it be that would be a moment that would be so highly erotically charged and so sexualized? And how could he think that she's so beautiful in that moment? That was a question that lingered with me for like 20 years. And so I felt compelled to come back to it. And I didn't expect it to be a Mediterranean question. I didn't expect it to sort of call out these other genres like fable or epic or travel narrative. But in the end, I saw some commonalities in the way these texts were exploring emotion and the way that they depended on the erotics of grief. And so the book came together in that sort of around that question and ended up exploring the its connections to these other genres.
Mm-hmm. And so you really hone in on grief. Do you, Is this like one of the prime emotions you're finding? Or is it just that moment that really caught you?
Well, I mean, definitely that moment caught me as an oddity because, you know, we often think about the medieval and we think about courtly love. You know, we've been taught to think there's these paradigms about knights and ladies, you know, in the general imagination of sort of popular culture. But in fact, it seems to me that if you are a little bit more attentive in your reading, a lot of the scenes that are about love in medieval texts are actually about suffering. They're not about how easy it is to be in love, but they're about how much you suffer when you're in love. And so I think that in romance, you have that sort of suffering that suffuses the text. But then if you look a little bit more carefully at epic, whereas it seems to be about sort of anger or rage, there's also a fundamental place for grief in epic because it wouldn't matter if everybody were out on the battlefield, if everybody came home at the end of the day. Like, I mean, there wouldn't be any decisions made. There wouldn't be any victory without grief, without death. And so in the end, grief becomes this sort of hidden or second layer, but fundamental emotion, probably even maybe more fundamental than, like, say, love, in the sense that without commemoration, without weeping, without sorrow, we don't have a lot of this sort of social structures reinforced throughout all of these genres of text. So for me, although these other emotions are also super important, grief becomes sort of one of the currents that ties together the emotional practices of the elite amongst many different genres of text, and I would argue more importantly in throughout Mediterranean culture.
Mm-hmm. So it becomes like grief then becomes like this way of sitting on other emotions, right? Exacerbate isn't the word I want, but it's amplifies kind of other emotions or notes them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what grief does is it provides a space for commemoration or it provides this space for valuing human life and determining, I guess, one of the bigger questions is, like, you know, how do we remember a life? What does a life mean? What is a life? How can we attribute value to a life? And grief is one of the primary ways we have of valuing and showing value for a life. The more people grieve, it's sort of a chiasma, right? Like, chiasmus is like the more people grieve, the more you recognize the loss they're feeling. You know, it's public. It's like a legible thing. Grief becomes this way of writing a narrative, a public narrative, through bodily signs, through tears, through sighs and cries, that is legible to the larger community that your loss matters or that this person mattered. And so it becomes this sort of eternal emotion rather than, a temporary emotion.
Mm-hmm. All right. I want to get into another point you make. Well, you say that you take emotions to be culturally contextualized performances of feelings. And this is a place where you're talking about the performance of emotion. So how does that work? How are emotions performatives?
Well, so in my work, I'm sort of following the theories of emotion that differentiate between, you know, the neurobiological model, which would be when, you know, you have a fight or flight response, say, to, being attacked by a bear or something like that. That's a cascade of hormones and sorts of like chemical responses in the body. But then there's the idea of a feeling, which would be something internal, which would be something that, you know, you privately feel, but you might not be verbalizing or you might not be expressing to anyone in a particular way. But then emotions in my work and in others' work are a way of thinking about an exchange between people. So when, you know, you feel it happy, you might be giving a smile, people might read your face. There's an exchange and there's a kind of reading community created. And then there's this sort of act of reading and deciphering that happens. so that every time you are expressing an emotion, it becomes an act of community because it interpolates another person and their ability to decode what you're putting out there. Then from there, you could think a little bit further to think about emotions as sort of performing community, you know. So like, for example, a good performance of an emotion is when it's acceptable in community. So if I take my child to the supermarket and they start screaming on the floor, that temper tantrum is not acceptable. And so you would maybe, you may upbraid the child or something and say, like, this isn't appropriate here. Likewise, laughing at a funeral, not appropriate. So we have these ways in which emotions perform the boundaries of community, because emotions become sort of like the code for how to act, how to feel. And so if you are acting and feeling and expressing feelings in community, so emotions in a way that your community can't accept, you are going to be beyond the boundaries of your community. You're going to be rejected. And so those are, a grief can become a performance of elite community in my book, because certain lives are grieved more than other lives. You know, certain performances of grief matter more to these texts than other performances of grief. So in that way, grief helps negotiate differences between people in status or place in community. And it helps not only differentiate between people, but reinforce the feeling of community amongst those performing it in the same way.
Right. And then because there's this dialectic of performance and acceptance, that becomes a very good, a way to see into an otherwise perhaps more distant or difficult to read culture, or part of culture.
Right. And I mean, I think that whereas we usually focus on maybe the more positive emotions, or, it's easier to think about love as uniting people. In my book, I'm exploring the ways in which grief might be kind of posited as a kind of emotional exceptionalism, in the sense that because grief inaugurates a hierarchy between people, we're getting a better, if you pay attention to grief, you can get a better viewpoint or more information about the ways that power is constructed in the Middle Ages. And so in this book, I'm reading from the vantage point of sort of the manuscripts that that are interested in reproducing privilege because of the way manuscript culture and patronage culture works in the Middle Ages. But another way would be to look at the holes, who cannot be grieved, who cannot show up in these narratives, whose lives are not the ones that are replicated over and over through song or through sighs and cries. And so I think that provides some insight into the ways that power might have worked in the Middle Ages as well.
I mean, spoiler alert, folks, but who is it? Who's worthy of grief? Who gets to be grieved? Sorry.
Well, unsurprisingly, it's the nobility. Well, I mean, I don't know that that is 100% an accurate claim, in the sense that what we have transmitted to us today from medieval texts are manuscripts that were paid for, commissioned, and designed to appease or please elite culture, elites. So the things that they contain are naturally more interesting and more flattering to the elites. So, because manuscripts are so expensive and so difficult to reproduce, what we have as material culture from and as source material from that time only sort of testifies to the place of the elite, whereas maybe there would be another narrative available if we had different kinds of sources. So, but within the text that we do have, they by and large imagine that elite lives are more worth mourning and are more worth paying attention to and reproducing and sort of immortalizing than, say, the 20,000 men that make up the army of Charlemagne's, slain soldiers that we just sort of hear about in passing.
Nowhere near as important as, someone who we love, a main character. Right, which is about manuscript tradition. But also one imagines, we get a very different, we would get a different picture if we were able to access other records, but you know, they're just not necessarily there.
Yeah. And I mean, the one way we could kind of imagine getting more of a picture is to look at the places that sort of are holes in the narratives that we do have, you know, and that's speculative, but it's something, you know.
Sure. Yeah. And there's work on like folklore and, you know, folk tales and such, but those are, you know, they're so old and like, there's such a long time between the oral retelling and when we've written them down, you know, that there's a lot there that's missing as well. It's just, it's a distant world, right?
Definitely.
There's just only so much we can do. So let's step away from grief for a minute and talk about desire. So, I mean, the title of the book is The Erotics of Grief. So we can see, no surprise, this speaks to the way grief is kind of intertwined with desire and love on some level. So, I mean, let's look at this. Like, what does desire signify for us?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that it within the world, sort of the textual world of these sources, as I said, that is very geared towards elite status and sort of elite courtly culture. Desire isn't just about love. And in fact, desire, I guess, let me restate that. What's interesting is that desire is framed within these texts as something that happens within marriage, whereas in the real medieval world, we know that most marriages were arranged and were by convenience. And so it's really interesting to think about love motivating relationships or desire motivating relationships at all. And then within the world of sort of these texts, I think what is even more interesting is to think about the ways that grief might become desirable. You know, it's counterintuitive because most of us think that what is desirable is to be alive, right? Is to be, you know, in our relationships, in our daily lives, you know, sort of flourishing in the here and now. But in the culture of this world that I'm exploring here, in fact, the desire is not just about that. It's also a desire for cementing power through immortality. And so the desire I claim in this book is not just about, you know, sexual or amorous desire between people, but it's about desire for commemoration, desire for narrative. And so grief becomes a way of sort of writing the story of someone's life. And so grief becomes desirable because if, you know, in that example I gave you about the knight riding up and saying to Enid, "You're so hot." Here, like, why would that grief be desirable? Well, it would be desirable because she's mourning another man, and her mourning becomes the gateway, the pathway for a story about a man's life. And so what is desirable is the way that grief leads to storytelling. And so there's something very erotic about being talked over and being being remembered.
Sure. And her grief reaffirms the value of the object of her grief, right? Like, this person matters because she's grieving. Well, I mean,
No, absolutely. So, you know, he's valuable because she is making him valuable.
Right. And that dialectic again. So she gets to grieve, right? This is a question we talk about who you might grieve about, but who is allowed to grieve or whose grief matters?
That's a great question. And I love that question so much because it is something that we ask today in a little bit different way in the dynamics of, you know, whose lives matter. And I think that there is a big parallel between today's questions about that and the ways that that we think about whose grief matters in the Middle Ages, in the sense that in the Middle Ages, there's a great disparity between some people who have a lot of privilege and money and power and the majority of people who don't. And to some extent, the people who have the power in the Middle Ages are the ones whose grief matters. And at the same time, their grief is imagined as exceptional or narratable, whereas, you know, commoners' grief might be helpful, but it isn't something that is individually paid attention to or explored in these texts. So you'll have instances where you'll have stanza after stanza or you know, page after page of people, the narrator talking about an individual noble's grief. And then you'll have like a couple of lines that 20,000 other men fell faint, right? Or that in another text, a bunch of citizens noticed that their lady was dying and you know, stormed up to the castle in order to express their grief. But we don't get any more information than that. So it seems like all grief matters, but some grief is exceptional. Some grief is worth paying attention to and worth commemorating in the form of a narrative.
Is that about the person who's grieving, the person who's grieved, or the relationship between the two of them, or all of the above? Or?
I think all of the above. So one of the theorists I engage with pretty heavily in the book is Judith Butler, and she writes this book called Precarious Life, in which she explores the relation between grief and power. And she asks this question, you know, who am I without you? Which is the question about, when I'm grieving and I've lost you, what is my identity anymore? Who am I anymore? And that's a really powerful question. But the question that I think medieval texts also remind us to think about is, who are you without me? That is, what exactly is the value of your life after you've gone if there isn't me to grieve you? And so I think that these texts are about, you know, the griever, the grieved, and their relationship between the two, how they're mutually informing, and they remind, and the medieval texts, I think, help us reformulate or add on to Butler's questions by reminding us that there's that sort of relationality between both the subject and the object of grief.
All right. You spend a lot of time on widows. Not a lot of time, but I mean, there's a chapter on widows in particular. What's special about the way widows grieve, or the grief of widows?
I think that widows have a really specifically precarious place in medieval culture. They are mistrusted, reviled, castigated in many texts because they are the, you know, many people have written that they are the only women who are mainly free to do what they want to do. They are suddenly in charge of their finances. They are no longer expected to marry or bear children. And so there's a lot of writing by medieval people and medieval church fathers, for example, who are worried about what widows are up to. And so being a widow is a precarious place. You're no longer protected either, though. I mean, you're both empowered and in a precarious moment. There's no social safety net, and there's no protection. And so, you know, the place of the widow is more precarious than the widower, for example. And yet widow's grief is very powerful in the sense that they can maintain the memory of the person they were affiliated with, and they can, you know, they can kind of create and shape a legacy. And at the same time, worries abound. For example, in the Fablio that I opened the book with, that women will quickly forget the deceased and move on. And so there's this sort of fraught, double-edged nature to women's grief that is dangerous and desirable at the same time.
These are women who are kind of out of place, right? They are not... And really unreliable and capricious. You just don't know what a widow is going to do you?
Yeah, and I mean, and I think that is sort of reinforced by Christine de Pizan, who is this widow of four young children when she herself is pretty young, and is also a poet. And so she, you know, it's an interesting sort of meta commentary because she's mobilizing grief in order to make money. And she also writes about grief and how alone she is. And so it seems to me that, you know, these church writings, the fictional accounts, and then this historical woman all point to the ways in which, you know, being a widow is out of place. And so you have to mobilize it strategically in order to be successful at surviving, you know, the loss. And I think it's really interesting. And so I think there's both this really empowered and this also like very dangerous status around around widows.
Yeah. Which leads me to some questioning about like how women in particular are allowed to grieve as opposed to how men grieve. And you work on masculinity as well, and I want to get there in a second. But is there some particularly feminine way to grieve? Is there an appropriate feminine way?
It feels like in these texts, what is scripted is that women should wail and cry as loud as possible and pull out their hair and scratch their faces and rend their garments. That's the standard description of proper female grieving. I think that what becomes, and you see that when women deviate or when they become bad grievers is when the texts sort of get very anxious. So in the Fablio, that the La Dame qui se fit foutre sur la face de son mari that I open the book with, the woman is considered an imperfect griever because she goes to her husband's tomb and is wailing and wailing, and another man comes up and says, like, hey, let's have sex here. And she goes for it. And then that's not okay with the in the text ethos. And so you see these, like, as soon as a woman stops grieving, it seems the message becomes like, that's an imperfect form of grief, unless it's for this other man who's even better and can sort of take over the status of the man for whom she's grieving. So we get these messages that women's grief should both last forever and then be packed up neatly as soon as another man needs her and her, the status she could bring.
All right. So exuberant, but under control.
Right. In a similar way to the status of the widow itself, women's grief is very precarious.
And highly subject to criticism, one imagines. It's funny how feminine emotion would work just like everything else.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. All right. But then let's talk about the other position, how the appropriate masculine grief.
Well, and so that's what's so exciting is you would think that it would be tempting to set up a dyad or a binary in which, you know, women's grief would be one way and men's grief would be another way. But really, when I was exploring these texts and for my book, it turned out, and what I found was that men's grief was just as desirable. Any kind of excessive grief is sort of scorned in the medieval mindset, in the sense that if you look at Augustine, for example, he says, you know, we need to think with eternal time and we should be always cognizant that, you know, we go back to our creator. And so, you know, what's more important is our eternal soul and life. So grief is misplaced. But in my readings, it turns out that it's particularly erotic men's grief because men are commemorating other men. And so in the world of chanson de geste or epic, of course, you know, men are witnessing and gazing upon the loss and the deaths and the sacrifice of these valiant warriors. And so the more that you can convince a man to grieve about you, the more there's sort of like an erotics of gazing and of commemoration that can be put out into society. And so the example that I think one of the most forceful examples is that where we often read the Roland or you could probably even make this argument about the Iliad as about rage or about warfare, we have countless scenes of Charlemagne grieving and he is pulling out his beard and doing a lot of the same gestures that the women do. And that is not emasculating or feminizing. It's on the contrary, it's valuing the culture of sacrifice and camaraderie and brotherhood that is imagined as the backbone for feudal society. And so, you know, Charlemagne's grief is not upbraided or considered feminizing, but rather is a sign for the depth of the loss and the value of, for example, Roland's life. And so it's really important and integral to feudal culture that men be grieving as well. And especially when you can get an emperor to grieve for you, you suddenly have like this incredible status accorded to you. So actually, whereas today, you know, if we saw a leader grieving, we might be perplexed or not know how to understand that. In the medieval world, the leader grieving was the highest sign of honor you could have.
Yeah, all right. So like a validation of your existence then. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And commemorative in the same way that women's grief is. Mm-hmm. And so the two kinds of grief are interweaving and working towards the same system in my reading.
All right. And then how does that spread out to the construction of a broader Mediterranean ethos?
Yeah. So like I said, I was not expecting to write a Mediterranean book again. But really, when you look at models for this kind of grieving, you can't help but go back to the Iliad, and you can't help but go back to Greek sources, and as well as Roman and Latin sources. But really, we have these models that are anchored in sacrifice that is, you know, inaugurated in these classic texts. And so what we, you know, the culture of sacrifice and warrior ethos and sort of commemoration and identity are all inaugurated in those fundamental texts and passed down through generations. And many of the medieval French texts and other texts that we have from the Middle Ages through processes of translatio delineate in the prologue that these are the very sources that they are interpolating and calling out to. So, you know, you'll have a prologue that will say, you know, just as, you know, knowledge moved from east to west, you know, from the Greeks to the Romans to the French, you know, they, you know, so I'm going to begin this tale. And the, you know, the authors are interpolating and calling out to a Mediterranean culture, textual culture, but also I would argue to a Mediterranean emotional culture. And so in the book, I unexpectedly sort of came to an argument where I was exploring emotions as sort of the language of the elite, so that there would be sort of a shared, I imagine, a shared emotional culture among the Mediterranean elite who would have more in common with each other than they would with commoners or peasants. They would have more commonalities among desiring a culture of commemoration and eroticizing grief as a, in service of power than they would with, you know, so somebody from their own country, but who may be a peasant. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that the Mediterranean provides this backdrop for a common emotional language that reinforces the channels of power between elites who are intermarrying and who are crusading and who are coming into contact with each other more and more throughout the 11th to 13th centuries.
Hmm. Yeah, all right. That's fascinating. The creation of the medieval world is something that I'm endlessly fascinated in as well. It's just how this interaction, and of course it makes sense, you know, when land divides and water unites, of course, like there's this culture, but it's really a cool thing to see. And I think, yeah, go ahead.
Well, and in my first book, I was exploring the culture of cross-culture, the sort of connections formed and exchanges possible in cross-cultural marriage. And so this sort of stems from that work, thinking about the ways that not only, you know, the structural aspects of cross-cultural marriage, but the emotional community created by all of these interweavings of these families throughout the Mediterranean makes it more likely that, you know, that there's a shared kind of culture of emotions, and especially around grief and its power to create narratives about noble glory, than there would be, you know, any particular local family's relationship to any peasants that would be in the area.
Either we're talking about the, you know, like these intimate moments that are very public though, right? They're like this intimacy that's actually not at all. So the publication of like a public marriage, for instance, and how you celebrate that, how you celebrate a death, or how you memorialize or commemorate that, this would be something that would join.
Yeah, the question is like whether there's any true intimacy possible for people who are so highly placed, you know, I mean, in the sense that it's almost all, one way of reading it would be to be that it would be almost all a performance of sort of identity and inclusion and status.
Yeah, and I mean, with that is that like your base, right? That we have these relationships that are these public performances, that then the commemoration of them, like the emotion that you have surrounding them, would be a public construction as well. Is and much more
Well,
likely to kind of cross culture.
yeah, and it kind of, I mean, one of the questions that comes out of that thinking then would be, you know, is there any performance of emotion that isn't performance? You know, I mean, is there any, you know, one of the questions medievals keep asking is like, well, are tears real or is it just a performance of a feeling? And in the, that is a question that sort of become, that is posed by these texts.
Do you have any feeling? Are tears real?
Well, I mean, yes, I think they are definitely. And I mean, I think that I don't mean to suggest like medieval people didn't have
Course.
emotions. I think that, no, I mean, I think that emotions are certainly real, but they can also be strategic. And so the texts that explore like that tension between when you see these, I mean, pages and pages of lovers bemoaning their absent other, you know, or wishing that so and so were in love with them, you know, that seems like a very private moment. It's psychologically meaningful and seems to have a lot of depth, but at the same time, it has this public function as well, which is to give value to the other.
Yeah, well, publicizing doesn't is not you know, having public emotion and or make having emotion and making a deal out of it are not mutually exclusive.
No, right.
No, then or now. All right, thanks. I've taken up very close quite a bit of your time already, so I just have one more question, which is what's next? What are you working on now?
Well, I'm actually working on an extension of this thinking around, you know, whose emotions matter and how does emotion help create communities, to think about the community of the human. So I'm working on cyborgs and emotion, and I'm thinking about the ways that medieval understandings of power and the human and emotions could inform readings of the human and sort of post-humanism in cyborg film. And so I've been working on thinking about the erotics of grief in Westworld, which is an HBO series about cyborgs, and in other cyborg film. And so I think I will pursue that next.
That's very exciting. I thought we were probably going to go with werewolves or something, but this is much cooler.
Medieval, I mean, I don't think it's necessary. It may be a little bit unexpected, but I don't think it's always anachronous to pair the medieval with the modern and even the postmodern and posthuman, in the sense that I think there are still a lot of commonalities between our cultures, even though it's very, very distant past. And I think that the, you know, questions about who is allowed to count for human and whose emotions matter and are still, they're pressing ones today, and they were in the Middle Ages too. So it's an exciting moment to be able to compare cyborgs and medieval subjectivities about emotion.
That's fantastic. I am very excited to read that. That sounds very cool. All right. Well, good luck on that. All right, Megan, thank you so much for taking some time with me today. It's been a lovely conversation.
Thank you so much. I'm really grateful, Jana.
All right. Bye-bye.